Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Tuesday, August 26, 2003. Today's session is entitled Practicing the Presence of God in Our Life, Session 1 of Guided Meditation and Prayer Experiences, presented by Sam Howell, number HOS 2003-01. Let's listen in.
My name is Sam Howell, and what I'd like to have us talk about today is the idea of practicing the presence of God in our everyday life, and that would be prayer, bringing prayer out of Sunday, bringing prayer out of our daily devotions, and trying to figure out ways to make that more integrated into our life on a moment-by-moment basis. This is not going to be a lot of guided meditation. I'll do a lot of that tomorrow. What it is primarily going to be tonight is a discussion about that topic. So I'm hoping that people, as we go through, will feel free to pipe up and say what their experience has been. I have some things that we could fill up an hour and 15 minutes with. We'll end a little bit early, so we've got a little bit of time between now and Vespers. But I would like nothing better to go off on a tangent and not get to anything that's written down on my piece of paper. Because that's really one of the reasons that I came to Holden. I wanted to engage people in this topic, in this discussion about prayer. So I'm hoping to hear and learn as much from all of you as hopefully I'll be able to impart. So that's my goal for the next hour. Before we get started, I do want to just read a short prayer to kick us off. This is a book of prayers by an Indian poet. Some of you may have heard of him, Rabindranath Tagore. Very powerful stuff. Accept me. Accept me, dear God. Accept me for this while. Let those orphaned days that passed without you be forgotten. Only spread this little moment wide across your lap, holding it under your light. I have wandered in pursuit of voices that drew me, yet led me nowhere. Now let me sit in peace and listen to your words in the soul of the silence. Do not turn away your face from my heart's dark secrets, but burn them till they are alight with your fire. Amen. I'm trying to decide. I was thinking that I would go around and have people introduce themselves to facilitate the discussion. I think with a group this large, that would take up more time than I want to. But I would be interested in finding out why people are here. Why are you at Holden? What draws you to Holden? I've never been here before. Some of you have been here many times. But what is it about Holden? Or if this is your first time, what is it about a retreat or a retreat center that would make you want to go there? Nothing?
I was just sharing with someone today that certainly you don't come here and find that you're free from all those things of your life that, you know, you could be distracted from whatever. There's certainly relationships and all that kind of stuff that goes on that we need to work on, and all the stuff that of ourselves can't escape. But there's enough of worldly distractions that are not here, traffic and news media and whatever, that is not here, that there's space enough that perhaps those other things can come up and have space to be looked at.
So it's freedom from some distractions, maybe not all, but
so not freedom from the stuff of life, but maybe the distractions, so that the real stuff that you might take a look at can emerge.
Okay.
That's one thing.
Okay. Have you been here before?
Yes.
How about other people? What what is it that draws you to a retreat center? One of the things that happened when I saved up some time from my job to be able to, I'll have been away from home almost 3 weeks. I spent a little less than two here, and then traveling back and forth, and I'm going to spend a day in Seattle. So I've been away from work for a significant amount of time. One of the things that I got various reactions when I told them what I was going to do with this 3 weeks. And one of the reactions was, "You're going to what?" You know, I think that going to a retreat center and taking time to do this kind of study and this kind of reflection is a little bit countercultural. A lot of people would want to take their vacation time and, I don't know, do whatever, go lay on a beach and relax. And this is a little bit more than that. So I'm wondering why, if some people had that reaction, or again, why are you here?
I sort of feel about it the same way as I feel about Sabbath, Sundays. Mm-hmm. The way that we need time at the end of a week to rest, recuperate, renew, whatever. This feels, I told my husband the other day, this doesn't feel like a vacation. This feels like our yearly Sabbath. It's only the second time we've done it, but it's just a time where you don't necessarily sit still and do nothing. It's not that kind of rest. It's just like what April was saying. The busy, hurried, everyday distractions are not there, so you can just focus better on what's important to you.
Well, that's come up twice. Let's talk about that a little bit. I was going to talk about it later. What is it that's in our lives that distracts us from having a prayerful attitude? What is it that distracts us from what we are seeking here? When we're out in, as people at Holden call it, when we're on an out, when we're, you know, not at Holden, what are the things in our lives that distract us?
Probably other people.
Other people distract you.
Schedules.
Mm-hmm. Obligations.
Working full time.
Yeah.
Probably more than full time, it sounded like.
Well, let me give you a little bit about my background. I'm not a pastor. I'm a lay leader in a Lutheran congregation in Bloomington, Minnesota. I have heard of Holden before. I've had former pastors at our congregation have led groups out here, brought folks out here. I've heard nothing but good things about it, but I've never been here. The reason that I got involved this year was Christine Carlson and Maury Wee were the program directors. They put together some of the speakers for the summer. And they were very encouraging. You know, you really have to get out there. It's a wonderful place. You'd fit right in, all of that stuff. So they convinced me that it was something that I should do, and it's been a great experience for me. I'm here till Thursday. I have my two boys out here with me. One of them said yesterday, was talking in terms of, you know, when we come back to Holden next year, I mean, not if we come back or should we come back, but when we come back, we should do this, because we're not going to be able to do everything we want to do. The other thing that I think has brought me to Holden is about 20 years ago, I was at a party. And someone was talking about this wonderful retreat that they had been on, run by the Jesuits, in a retreat house outside St. Paul, Minnesota. There, he worked on, I mean, he talked about it. It's a silent retreat. It's a guided meditation retreat. 3 days, go out on a Thursday, come back on a Sunday. It sounded very interesting to me, but he worked on me for about a year to convince me to go out there. And I think I've missed 1 year since then. It's been this wonderful formative experience for me, and it's really expanded my idea of what prayer is all about, and the place of prayer in my life. So the things that I've been trying to do here have been to not really teach about that kind of prayer as much as offer some chances to talk about that and experience that a little bit, and hopefully pique some interest in folks when they go back to their home congregations or wherever they've come from to seek out some different experiences like that. So that's my overall goal at Holden. One of the things, about 10 years ago, I started getting into reading books about medieval Christian mystics, people that spent their whole life in prayer and meditation, trying to get closer and feel the presence of God on an ongoing basis. And there's a very interesting history about all of those folks. But as I was reading them, it occurred to me that that was not something that I could ever do. I could never devote that much of my life to that kind of a quest, even though I may have found it admirable. And then one year on retreat, spiritual director that was running the retreat talked about, he said, you know, all a mystic is someone that is trying to keep in mind that God is present in every moment of their life and is striving for that kind of an awareness. And I thought to myself, you know, I can do that. I can be that kind of a mystic. And so that was about 10 years ago, and that's really been a jumping off point for me. And the rest of the time we'll probably do a couple of exercises, one for sure. But we'll be talking about how we might do that. So anybody ever, I'm just curious if people have what their experience level is with silent prayer and meditation and using that. Is that something that is an experience that people have had? Is it something that goes on in your congregation? I know it certainly isn't something that has gone on in mine over the years. Have people had experience in this kind of guided meditation or long periods of silence and worship? I see some. Anybody want to share what that's like, been like for them?
Our church, I think we have during Lent a series of Taizé style services
okay.
that have a lot of darkness built into them. And many, many of our people have difficulty being calm and silent.
Mm-hmm.
We try to specify that as you enter the sanctuary, you should be silent and not visible to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Very difficult for people to do that. And I take that as a reflection of our whole life, that we just can't be calm.
Mm-hmm.
We can't be silent. Right? We play music, but it's background music. We don't ever just sit
mm-hmm.
down in our living room, turn on the music, and listen to it, and nothing else.
Yeah. One of the things that they talk about a lot at the retreat center is silence is more than not talking. You know, that silence is, to a certain extent, an attitude. I mean, there's upwards of 60 men on this retreat every year when I go. I think they run retreats every year except two or three out of the year. And most of the time, the retreats are full. Most men are going on this silent retreat once a year. So it's must have value for people to draw people back year after year like that. But you can have 60 men out there, and some of us, you know, I got there because of a friend, and that friend still goes there. And even though it's a silent retreat, there is some time to get to know folks before and afterwards. Many of the men that I've been on this retreat with have been there every year that I've been there. So some connections have been made. So even though we're silent, it's very easy to not be silent by kind of making eye contact or, you know, hand gestures or,
you know, making sure that you have to sit next to someone at a meal, or any of those things that kind of distract you from yourself. They first couple of years when I went out there, I used to go out there and I'd have a stack of books this high that I was going to read in those 3 days. And I've kind of quit taking books out there because I think that's, you know, that's a way of not being silent. I mean, that's a way of kind of distracting myself from whatever it is that's going to happen for me out there. Another thing that I used to do that I very quickly learned doesn't work is I used to go on retreat with an agenda. This is what I'm going to think about, and this is what I'm going to work on, and this is what I'm going to decide. Almost invariably, I ended up being led in some different direction, and the more I tried to stick to my agenda, the more I got in the way of where I ultimately would find God was leading me. So it really is a time for me every year to slow down and reflect. What I'd like to do just for 5 minutes is to get a sense, if you've never done this kind of an exercise before, to get a sense of what it is to pray in a different way than a petitionary prayer where we're praying about a specific topic, or we're praying for something, for someone, but to just hold an image in your mind and try and just center yourself, calm yourself, and try and get in touch with the God being present with you in the moment. Don't think about what you have been doing all day. Don't think about the hike that you're planning tomorrow, but to really try and just reflect and be in the moment with an image that I'm going to give you. The other day I was walking back behind the Narnia building, and I ran across the fire ring, which I didn't know was down there. We're not using it because we're under fire restrictions right now, but if you go down there, and actually as I've gone on hikes too, I found the same thing. But down by the fire ring, there's just this huge circle of pines that just shoot up to the sky. I don't know how old they are, but it's just this wonderful place. And on some of the hikes that I've been on too, we're walking through old growth forest that as far as I can tell, don't appear that they've ever been logged off. And so you have these big open spaces with these huge trees. That inspired me to pick this image. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to just read it a couple of times, and I'd ask people to use it as a way to kind of close your eyes if you want. Just reflect on this. Try not to do anything other than to try and hold this image in your mind. It's the shortest prayer in this book. Be still, my heart. These great trees are prayers. Be still, my heart. These great trees are prayers. Let's pull ourselves back together here. There's a point in the retreat that I go to every year. At the end of the retreat, after our last worship service together, Sunday evening we go down to evening meal, and that's the point at which the silence is broken. And it's after 3 days of, you know, pretty reflective calm and silence, and it's not complete silence. You've got a retreat director giving talks, you know, we're worshiping together, we're hearing tapes at the meals of on different topics. But when everyone begins talking again, it's just deafening. And I have the same experience every year that I go. I kind of feel the same way even after 5 minutes of silence, and people were very silent and reflective just now. When I spoke, it was just kind of like boom, you know, it's almost a shock. What was that like? Was it hard to concentrate? Was it hard to keep that image in your mind? What was people's experience?
We live in mm-hmm. And I think we're spoiled because it was very easy to imagine that fire under the tall trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then to go on how long it took for them to grow. Oh, God is always there.
Just past that fire ring, there's a big rock that I sat on for an hour today,
mm-hmm.
and behind me was the rushing water,
mm-hmm.
and I remember sitting there and looking up at those trees and the
mm-hmm.
vivid blue sky and the wind back and forth, and so I just had that very vivid
yeah.
picture because I just experienced it this afternoon.
To me, those trees took on life and a soul, and the reaching up of millions of trees to give glory to God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking if this could be us as human beings in mass giving that type of
mm-hmm.
acknowledgement of where I came from and whose power I'm under, was tremendous.
Every day when I go to work, 5 days a week. Those of you that I know that there's a lot of Minnesotans here, you may be familiar with the area around the Twin Cities Airport. It's right on the Minnesota River. I live in Bloomington. I have to drive over to downtown St. Paul, so I have to go over the river every day that I drive to work. And it's pretty wild. It's not unusual to see egrets and other wading birds down in the valley as I cross over the bridge. I think, and one of the things that I think we can do to bring the presence of God into our everyday life is to look for God in nature. You know, we walk through our landscape, even if it's an urban landscape, and I think ignore a lot of that creation and just kind of take for granted the things around us. We may not be able to be praying a petitionary prayer every minute of our lives, but we certainly can try and make the attempt to appreciate the landscape that we walk through on an ongoing basis, even if it's an urban landscape. That's the other reason I like that meditation piece, because it is, you know, being silent, you know, is an attitude, it's an awareness. It doesn't have to be not talking, it can be, you know, trying to be aware and be centered in some of the experiences that we have, maybe here at Holden, maybe in other parts of our life.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
I had two experiences yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I went out to the labyrinth.
Yes.
And in walking the labyrinth by myself,
mm-hmm.
I had a dialogue sort of with God and myself,
mm-hmm.
but it was silent. But the fact that I was moving made it so that my, you know, I was talking or
mm-hmm.
saying or working out issues that I think I need to improve in my life, sort of.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, I went down to the creek by myself and put my feet in water for a long time, probably an hour and a half. And the babbling brook, that sound cleaned, you know, I didn't have so much dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
but just tried to listen, like you say, to the voice of God. I think I hear that in water, whether it be the waves of the ocean, or in this case, a babbling brook, or today when we went to a waterfall, the pound, the roar of a waterfall, that there's God's voice there. What does God's voice sound like? To me, that I hear it in water. And gosh, deer were walking around, not afraid of me, drinking out of the river, and the sun was setting, and I just was overcome. But there wasn't a lot of dialogue then. Mm-hmm. It was just listening and absorbing and cleaning my head up.
And I guess part of what I'm talking about is you had a very powerful experience of that today, and to allow that to be triggered in other parts of your life. There are huge ravens out at this retreat center, and when things are silent, you're very aware of these ravens and the call that they have out there. It's a fairly rural area, and it's actually an old estate of some folks that ran a paper company in the Twin Cities, and there are cornfields around there, so you get deer walking through. And I find myself often looking up at the sky and noticing the clouds. And about 2 months after I came back from a retreat one day, I walked out early in the morning and I heard a raven calling. I looked up in the sky and it was this beautiful cloudy thing. And on my way to get on the freeway, in this little creek bottom that I go over, there was a deer. All of those three things brought me back to that retreat experience. Now, you can say that's coincidence, you can say, well, it just happened that way. But I think if you take the attitude that is connected to the experience that you have on a retreat, that's another way to try and pull this presence out of this experience back into your life every day. And it's really, from my point of view, it's an attitude. That I'm going to look for those things, and I'm going to make those connections. But that's great. I mean, and the labyrinth is still on my list to do before I leave. So, the other experience that I had was I was listening to the kids, and you know, sometimes when you're in that kind of a silence, stuff happens, you know, and there's probably two trains of thought. You try and bring yourself back to the image that you've been given, or you take that distraction and make that, you know, the centering point. And that's what I ended up doing, and maybe it's because I've used this exercise before. Those of you that know a little, that went to my other session, know a little bit about my history. My wife and I had a stillborn child after a full-term pregnancy, and we've got two boys after that. My older boy, you know, when he was younger and maybe still is, a bit of a handful. So we're up at the communion rail one time, and you know, he's kind of throwing a fit up there and creating a ruckus, and I'm terribly embarrassed. And after church, you know, somebody that had been up at the rail with me came up to me and he said, you know, and I immediately started apologizing for the behavior of my son. And he said, no, don't apologize. That's a wonderful sound to have up at the communion rail. And that's kind of where I went with the sound of the kids outside. Yeah, maybe they're a distraction when we're trying to do something like this, but that's a wonderful sound to hear when you're at Holden. So, there's a very good book that I read a couple of years ago. I don't have a copy with me because I read it on retreat. They have a small library, and I broke my rule of trying not to read on retreat. It's called Prayer for Beginners by Peter, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name even. It's K-R-E-E-P-T. I kind of hate to call it creeped, but it's not a theological treatise, and there are all kinds of different acronyms that people use for prayer and how to structure prayer. But his thoughts, I think, were helpful to me, so I mentioned it. It's Prayer for Beginners by Peter Crypt. It's Ignatius Press. The first thing that he says that you need for prayer is you need to stop. And hopefully that's what we did with that centering exercise. We tried to stop. And hopefully, you know, maybe that's what we've done by coming to Holden. We've stopped. Now there's a lot of ways to do that. You know, a centering exercise like the one we just did might be one of those. The next thing is to look, and I'd like to talk about that for a little bit here. What do we overlook? What do we overlook in our life that we, again, just assume is coincidence or assume is commonplace, but really isn't? Really is something that's gone on in our lives that's important and from God. Let me give you an example. It's tough for me to come up with a real good example, but back in 1980, before I was married, I got a call from my dad one time, who said, and you kind of, you got to know my dad. He was a school administrator. The part of the business that he loved was the financial end of it. So he's kind of a down-to-earth, by-the-book kind of guy. But he calls me up and he says, I just want you to know, I'm going down to the Mayo Clinic tomorrow. They're going to check something else. Nothing's going to happen. It's going to be fine. But I just thought you should know. Well, he wouldn't have called me, number one, if it wouldn't have been something. He hadn't been to a doctor, I bet you, in 10 years, so you know something's up. But don't worry, we'll call you tomorrow after everything's done. So they went down to the Mayo Clinic. I got a call the following night. Said, well, you should know, they're going to do surgery tomorrow. They're going to take a biopsy. I've got a growth on the bone of my right arm. If it's cancer, I've already signed the papers. The only thing that they can do is amputate my arm. So within 48 hours, I go from everything's fine to this tremendous crisis. That is indeed what happened. They did a biopsy, very fast growing form of cancer. The only thing to do to prevent it from seeding into the main part of his body was to amputate his arm. A horrible experience. But as I look back on it, and I'm not one that thinks that God puts things in our lives to test us or has these terrible things happen to us, but as I look back on it, I see tremendous good that came out of that experience. My youngest brother, I was the angel of the family, being the oldest of three boys. My middle brother was the quiet brother, and my youngest brother was the hellion, and really drove my parents crazy. He before this surgery happened, he literally had not talked to my father for a couple of years. It was their relationship was just so strained and tense. What happened as a result of that crisis in my family's life was the family dynamics changed. I count that as the point at which I became an adult, became less dependent on my parents as parents, and became, because I ended up taking on a lot in the first 6 months after my father died. My brother repaired his relationship with my father. In fact, he's probably closer to my dad now than any of the three boys. He lives 20 miles away and sees them frequently. And just, you know, amazing stuff came out of that experience. Now, at the time as I was going through it, was I aware that those dynamics were changing? Sure. I mean, I could kind of see it going on. But it really was with that amount of perspective that I understood what God was doing through that situation. I think there's all kinds of things that happen in our life that if we stopped and thought about it, we could see the hand of God in. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know what it takes for us to do that, but I think that is another way that we can try and bring the presence of God into our everyday life. What is it that we're doing on a daily basis? What are the experiences that we're encountering, and what is it that God's trying to do in us through those experiences? Now, that's very philosophical and pie in the sky, maybe, but I'm just convinced, and maybe as I get older I see it more because I can look at my life with a little bit more perspective, but I'm just convinced that there's all kinds of things, all kinds of situations going on in our life that we just, again, assume that it's happy coincidence or blind luck or it's just the way things kind of worked out. And I think we really give God short shrift in, you know, when we view it that way. And you know, deprive ourselves of that sense of, you know, God being in our life. It doesn't have to be this big dramatic example like the one that I just gave, but can people think of things that have happened in their life when they look back at them, they see the good that's come out of them, or they understand things? Yes?
Mine actually, I think, was something that happened, and I saw it right then and there. But 2 years ago, we left to go to Hawaii, and I had been taking care of my dad, who had Alzheimer's, for 3 years. And so he was, you know, I didn't tell him I was leaving because he wouldn't have known anyway.
Right.
But an hour after our plane took off, he wound up going into the hospital and wound up being the very final days of his life. And he didn't know I'd left, and I didn't know that this dramatic change had happened in that brief period of time. And Bruce was not with us quite yet. He was leaving like 5 days later. But I had the kids, and we landed, and he told me that this was what just happened. Do I need to come home? I had been with him except for 2 weeks, for 3 years. And it was just like this amazing peace that said, no, I shouldn't be there. I should not be there at all for some reason. And of course I want to be with my dad in those last few days. But it was just this, I've been there for 3 years and this happens an hour after I leave. Well, nobody else in my family was able to deal with this whole thing. And they always knew that I was there. And it was only when I was gone that they actually came because I wasn't there. And so I called my brother and he goes, well, maybe you need to come home. And I said, no, I think I'm not supposed to come home. And he wound up going up there. My mom, who was divorced from my dad, wound up going over, and really amazing healing things happened with every member of the family. And as I saw this all playing out, I go, I'm supposed to be gone, and I don't know why all that happened. But it was a tremendous peace, and he died while I was gone. But I've never felt like I should have been there because, you know, the situation. But it was very different, because usually I see it later. Sometimes years or decades later, I say, oh, that's what that was about. But I think it's one of those rare times where I actually saw it right in the midst of it.
Yeah. And the key is to, I mean, that's a dramatic experience, but there are probably little things that go on in our life all the time that if we'd acknowledge them, we'd have that same feeling that you have there.
I have a really mundane thing, just an ordinary thing of life, but I come from a small town. We have a very busy dentist, and he knows that he can call us at any time he has a cancellation. I hate going to the dentist. It's the worst thing that can happen. And I had been out for a walk and came home, and my husband said, well, you can go into Dr. Ryder's this afternoon, and he'll begin to work on the crown. I needed a crown, so do I have to go? And I finally decided, well, I better take the appointment. And I went in, and he started work on the crown. He said, now we need to take an x-ray to make sure everything's clear. And he did, and he found I had a root canal. And, you know, right away I said, thank you, God. The last thing I would have wanted to have happened would have been here in Holden Village suffering from a root canal. So, you know, it was just, I call it a small miracle that I said, yes, I'll go,
sure.
And that he found it before I got here. It was just a simple little everyday occurrence.
To support that perspective of God being in everything, we've tried to, at our church, kind of strike the word luck from our vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really kind of taken root. I mean, our boys have even called me on it when I have slipped once in a while and said, that boy, that was lucky. But there are ways that you can just say, you know, when something really good happens, boy, that was a stroke of grace. Or boy, we were really blessed here, or blessed with that, which lifts up that, you know, that it's more than luck. Now, conversely, when bad things happen, people sometimes want to say, well, I know there was a reason. And I haven't found that Bible verse in the Bible yet. I think there's a reason for everything that happens. There's a reason for bad things to happen, but the reason oftentimes is sin. It's not God. You know, bad things happen, and then Romans 8:28, God helps us. God works for good in all things. But the reason for a lot of bad things is sin. We live in a fallen world.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with it. You know, I think I had a pastor a few years ago that called me on that very issue. I called something that had happened in the church blind luck, and he called me on it. And I think that's a great perspective. I mean, you know, calling something lucky or you know, a coincidence, or oh, isn't that nice how that worked out? You know, I think that sells things short. And on the other piece, I guess I feel like when we're looking at situations that are bad situations, we've got a responsibility to be open to what good may come of it too. Because it's not just stuff happening to us, I think, that we need on some level to be proactive and make something good come out of it sometimes as well.
God causing Barb's dad to go get sick when she goes to Hawaii. I mean, well,
yeah.
He becomes sick. That's what happens, and then God works for good. Works it for good.
Yeah.
Approximately a year ago, I was visiting a VA hospital. I had an appointment there, and I walked by, and I got kind of set the stage. This is in Seattle. It's a very busy. I mean, it's like a city within itself.
Mm-hmm.
People go in this way, that way. And this fellow was in a wheelchair. I didn't pay too much attention. I was just pleasing on my way. And he made eye contact and said, hi. I said, hi, how are you? And he said, blessed. Mm-hmm. And I looked at him, and he had both of his legs missing. Mm-hmm. Well, this kind of not knowing where all of this was going, and I come right back to your point about seeing the hand of God. I think I see blessings tied in with that too. Approximately 4 months ago, I had a tumor removed from my brain. And at the beginning, I had to listen to a litany from a neurosurgeon telling me all the many things that could go wrong. I had to listen to the whole program. And when he got all done, I had the opportunity to tell him, well, I understand all those things, but God's in charge. He's in charge of this. And the point is that he took me through that. I, I guess it was about 2 weeks after that, I had a violent reaction to one of the medications. Well, there were blessings in that too. I met people in there, I met just guys sweeping the floor. And as I look back, I saw the hand of God from the top, from the very beginning all the way through. And the thing that's kind of neat is that I think it's too recent to see all those things. And I think little triggers throughout my days, I see things, just even, you know, bring other things to my mind saying, wow.
The thing I did yesterday, and some of you were there, is kind of a writing exercise to try and get at looking at the arc of our life and things that have happened, and maybe things that happened when we were a kid somehow prepared us for things farther on in life. Just as a devotional exercise sometime, I'd encourage people to just sit down and try and write out their life story and try and make some of those connections. When I've done that, it's been amazing what has come out of that and the connections that I've understood that I didn't realize were there. So Peter Krebs would say we have to stop, we have to look and be aware of what's going on around us, and we need to listen. And this, some of this stuff we've already talked about, this awareness of God and nature on my drive to work every day. That can be a prayer, you know, that awareness can be a prayer. It doesn't have to be a prayer with words, but it can be practicing this sense of God's presence in our lives. This understanding that we've just talked about the providential directing of our lives versus blind luck, and trying to understand how God is working in the world and in people that we meet, I think can be a way that we listen. And then there is the listening that comes through reading and studying and understanding the scripture. And so that's another way that we can listen. That's by far not an exhaustive list. Are there other ways that we can listen? Other ways that you listen?
Nature's a powerful way, mm-hmm. but also just the godly counsel of Christian friends and family members, their perspective, their wisdom.
I have had the experience. And I, you know, I feel very strongly that people ought to be part of some kind of faith community. I'm not. That's just what I need to feel connected to people and grow. So that godly counsel piece is a good one. But I also think that there are people that are not Christian maybe in my life, or are maybe people that I work with that I relate to in a different way than I do to the faith community that I belong to, but that if I'm listening to them, I sometimes hear from them things that challenge me and things that direct me in my Christian life. So I'd encourage people to listen to all of the people and try and gain that perspective too. Trying to think of an example where that's been the case for me.
That other course or session that's going on this week, the media.
Oh, yeah.
yeah. where there may be yeah. theological themes and yeah. insights.
Yeah. yeah. And again, it's that, you know, it's maintaining that sense of presence so that we can, you know, not discount them, but be aware of them. Things that I'm debating with the time we've got left whether to do this exercise, and I don't think I'm going to, but I'll give you an example of how you can work with scripture that's maybe some of you have done this before, but maybe some of you hadn't. And what I was going to do was give an example and then have you do it. I don't think we've got time for that, but I think I can briefly give an example. And so if you have a Bible and want to follow along, you can, but you don't have to. I'm just going to read the passage. And we are in John chapter 8. It's the story of the woman caught in adultery. While Jesus went to the Mount of Olives, early in the morning he came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in adultery, and making her stand before all of them, they said to him, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. Now what do you say?" They said this to test him so that they might have some charge to bring against him. Jesus bent down and wrote his finger in the ground. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." And once again he bent down and wrote in the ground. And when they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus was left alone with the woman standing before him. Jesus straightened up and he said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" She said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you. Go your way, and from now on, do not sin again." There's a way to go through scripture, and the idea is it's a meditation practice that the Jesuits sometimes use. I've used it on this Jesuit retreat. And the idea is that you read the scripture and then you go back and you place yourself in the position of one of the characters in the scripture. You try and understand the emotions that they might have been feeling. You try and understand their body language. What are they thinking? What are they doing? Why are they doing it? And you read the passage again very slowly, and you look for things that catch your eye, and you try and understand them. I did this with this passage on retreat one time, and let me, as an example, just show you what I came up with. And this, I'm no theologian, and there's probably a theological treatise to be written on this passage. That's not where I'm at, but this was my meditation on this. So he's in the temple, and the scribes have set a trap for him. You know, they brought in this woman, and they're trying to get him to say that they should kill this woman. If he says that, he's going to lose, to a certain extent, the support and ministry of the poor and outcast that he's been working on. If he says, "Don't stone her," then he's not following the law of Moses. So he's really in a pickle here. You know, he has no idea. I mean, there's no good answer to this. So what does he do? They've set this up. They brought the woman before him. They ask him what they should do. They point out the law of Moses. And he turns his back to them and leans over and starts drawing in the dust. What is he drawing? Why is he doing that? I think he's stalling for time. I think he's kind of like we would if we were trying to figure out what to say next, going, "Okay, what should I do here?" And so then he gets up, turns around, and says, let anyone who's without sin be the first to throw a stone at her. And then he turns his back on him again, leans over and starts growing in the ground. And I can almost picture him kind of glancing over his shoulder, what's happening back there, what's going on. And slowly, one by the one, the scribes don't have a real answer for this. He's gotten out of this pickle, and they kind of just drift off. And he stands up again, and he doesn't stand up and turn around. He stands up and says, are they gone? You know, it's like this very human, you know, understandable, I can relate to this reaction to this situation. I just love looking at, and Gospels are great for doing this. I love looking at stories like this because they really just almost jump off the page if you do this kind of devotional thing. It's just a technique, you know, try it sometime. It takes a little getting used to, and you have to kind of get out of the Western mind, the Western mentality of I need to figure out what this means and just kind of experience what's going on. But it's really an amazing process when you try it. So I was going to have you do it. If you want to do some homework, try doing it with John 12. That's the story of Mary and Martha at the dinner where one anoints the feet and the other one gets mad, you're wasting money. It's a good one to do it with. John 12. Couple of thoughts, and then I'll open it up for a few minutes if people want to just throw out one last thought too. The other thing that this Peter Krepp book talks about is prayer requires three things: faith, hope, and love. Faith, because we don't feel or physically know God is there. We can't prove the existence of God. And I used to try and do this when I was in college all the time. I was going to prove to you that God existed. I am very far away from that now. I mean, I've experienced God in my life, so he's real to me, and I hope that other people experience him and have that same sense, but I can't give that to them. I can't make them feel that. I can't prove it to them. So it requires faith. It requires hope. The only reason that we expect that our prayer is going to count is because God promised that it would count. And I'm talking about not just, again, petitionary prayer, but just this prayer that we speak every day in our lives by being aware of his presence in our lives. The passage about, and this came up when I did this last week, the passage about pray without ceasing has always been a tough one for me. You know, how can I do that? How can I pray without ceasing? Well, if we're practicing the presence of God in our lives, and if we've expanded our vocabulary of what prayer is, then I think it's possible. I think we can pray without ceasing. And love is the last thing. We wouldn't want to pray. We wouldn't want to get closer to God if there wasn't that love connection. Sometimes, you know, the question is, what do we say in a prayer? And I think that's a real Western idea. We have to fill up the space with words. I don't mean to let people think that there's something wrong with petitionary prayer. I think that's important. It has its place, but I don't think that's all of what prayer can be. I love Mother Teresa, and I love finding quotes of hers. One of the quotes is this: some theologians think too much. They talk too much. They should pick up a broom and sweep the room. That says enough. I think about the volunteers that come out to Holden and do things. You know, one of the things that I really think is very cool out here is all of the teaching staff get scheduled for Garbo and Dish Team. You know, it kind of levels the field a little bit, but I think it also talks a little bit about work as prayer. Without going into a long story, I worked in a residential program with adolescents for about 20 years, and now I'm in a human resource department for Ramsey County in Minnesota. I think in both of those areas, even though they're not Christian contexts, I can find ways where my work has meaning, where my work is important, and where I've been called to be doing that work. And you know, there are people that come out here and are serve on staff in, you know, as repairmen and working in the laundry the whole time they're here. But that work can be a prayer if you take that attitude with it. So I like that quote. The other thing about prayer, and it's another Mother Teresa quote, is God does not demand that we be successful. God demands that we be faithful. I think sometimes, you know, when we get frustrated with prayer, we think, you know, there's something wrong with us, you know, we don't have a very good prayer life. Well, sometimes silence isn't easy. Sometimes prayer isn't easy, and you just kind of have to keep plugging away at it and be faithful with it. And that's the expectation. That's a lot of stuff thrown at you all at once, a lot. It's kind of where I'm at with prayer. Any other comments, thoughts? Was this helpful? I'm all for finding prayer resources in all kinds of funny places. The internet is one. If you come tomorrow to this guided meditation, I'll share with you something that I found on the internet that I found very powerful. And I'll, if there's a topic, I'll just go in and punch it in as a search and see what I come up with. Sometimes I've come up with amazing stuff. And I'm pretty cross-cultural when I start thinking about prayer too. Book that I read from that early prayer is Heart of God by Rabindranath Tagore. He's Hindu, but very powerful stuff. There's all kinds of good books about prayer. Pocket Guide to Prayer, this is an Augsburg book. There's just all kinds of real practical suggestions, you know, about prayer. I think praying a lectionary can be good on an ongoing basis. There's all kinds of them out here. This is one that's more meditative in nature, praying the daily gospels. Classic book on prayer, O Hallowsbe, which is called Prayer. And if you like C.S. Lewis, a little bit intellectual, but Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. It's got some good stuff in it. So I just encourage people to look for things where they can find them. And finding books of prayer that speak to you are great. This one is, I'm going to read one and we'll kind of close off with that and get ready for Vespers. This is Fortress Press. It's Walter Brueggemann, who is a professor of Old Testament at Columbia Theological Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. But he, I don't know a lot about him, but he's kind of real social justice oriented. A lot of these prayers in here are very activist oriented. The one I'm going to read isn't particularly that way, but I think it fits for what we've been talking about. So take this as a prayer. We arrange our lives as best we can to keep your holiness at bay, with our pieties, our doctrines, our liturgies, our moralities, our secret ideologies, safe, virtuous, settled. And then you and your dreams, you and your visions, you and your purposes, you and your commands, you and our neighbors, we find holiness not at bay, but probing, pervading, insisting, demanding, and we yield, sometimes gladly, sometimes resentfully, sometimes late or soon. We yield because you, beyond us, are our God. We are your creatures, met by your holiness. By your holiness made ourselves true, and we yield. Amen. Thanks for coming. Thanks for talking. It's always great.